In the coming week, top security officials from Japan and South Korea hold their first meeting with the new U.S. National Security Advisor. The IMF and World Bank host their spring meetings, and top European Union officials meet with Turkish President Erdogan. It's April 1st, 2021, and time for The World Next Week. I'm Bob McMahon.
And I'm Jim Lindsay.
Jim, tomorrow is April 2nd, and the day that U.S. National Security Advisor Jake Sullivan is set to meet with top Japanese and South Korean security officials. The meeting is going to primarily focus on North Korea, and it'll be the first time that these three countries are meeting with the Biden administration under this multilateral format, the National Security Advisor level meeting. Can you give us a bit of sense of the background of this and why this meeting is significant?
Certainly, Bob. The meeting is set to take place at the U.S. Naval Academy in Annapolis, Maryland. You're right that North Korea, or as the White House statement diplomatically put it, peace and stability on the Korean Peninsula will top the formal agenda, but it's going to be joined by issues like COVID-19 and climate change. And that said, two other issues not on the formal agenda are sure to be discussed: China and Japanese-South Korean relations. Let's do North Korea first, Bob. Whether you think Donald Trump's summit with Kim Jong-un was a bold effort to break a diplomatic logjam or an amateurish and vainglorious gambit destined to failure, it in fact failed in its ostensible goal to persuade Pyongyang to denuclearize. North Korea's nuclear and ballistic missile programs are further along today than they were 4 years ago. That fact was punctuated last week when North Korea launched two short-range ballistic missiles. That was the first such test in a year, in a violation of UN Security Council prohibitions on such tests. The best guess is that the missile that was tested was a new solid fuel weapon designed to avoid detection by defense systems, and a missile that is also easier to hide from surveillance. But whatever the technical merits of the new design, the test has been widely interpreted as a challenge to the Biden administration. The problem the president faces, though, is that the range of options for dealing with Pyongyang haven't improved with time. On the one hand, the United States could accept North Korea's nuclear status. I think that is a political non-starter. The option at the other end of the spectrum is the use of military force. That's probably even more unacceptable. So you're left in this middle zone of some mix of economic pressure and reward on Pyongyang, which has been tried time and time again, and so far hasn't worked to persuade North Korea to give up its nuclear weapons. And of course, this latter route of trying to put pressure on North Korea really hinges on getting China's cooperation. So maybe here we should talk just briefly about how China figures into tomorrow's conversation. Again, China is not formally on the agenda. That's because doing so would only play into the Chinese narrative of being encircled. But everyone knows that China and China's actions are hanging over this meeting because the Biden administration has made it job number one to work with like-minded countries to coordinate economic and diplomatic policies that will deter and discourage aggressive Chinese behavior. I would expect that National Security Advisor Sullivan will give his Japanese and South Korean counterparts a debrief on last month's Anchorage meeting and also give them insight into overall U.S. thinking about how to approach China. In particular, I think there'll be a fair amount of discussion about recent Chinese efforts to intimidate Taiwan. I'll note that earlier this week, Taiwan and Japan both announced Chinese incursions into their respective air defense identification zones. And the level of U.S. concern about Chinese policy toward Taiwan, I think, was highlighted this week when the chief U.S. diplomat in Australia said that the United States has begun undertaking strategic planning with Australia in the event that China should attack Taiwan. But of course, this concern about Taiwan and standing up to Chinese aggression runs counter to what the Biden team wants to do on North Korea, where they want to get Chinese cooperation. Obviously, China is not in the business of doing favors for the United States, especially in this climate. And just the third thing I think it's really going to be hovering around this meeting is going to be the state of Japanese-South Korean relations. The fact is that Japan and South Korea have very difficult relations. Remember, the United States has an alliance with Japan. It has an alliance with South Korea, but there is no trilateral alliance. There's no alliance between Japan and South Korea. They've had very difficult relations, which dates back to a long history of enmity resulting from the fact that Japan colonized South Korea during the first half of the 20th century. But obviously, from the American point of view, if you're trying to get countries to coordinate policy, particularly vis-a-vis China, you want them to work together, not at loggerheads. And I think that's going to be a challenge for U.S. diplomacy going forward.
Yeah, Jim, I think given what you just staked out, you know, with the concern about North Korea's, ramping up of both rhetoric and testing and showing its military capability, with China's growing assertiveness, basically every week you're hearing about new incidents or maneuvers going on, it would seem to be making the difficulties between Japan and South Korea both more crucial to overcome, but also maybe something they can put aside maybe more. I'm wondering if the fact of this meeting, this trilateral meeting in and of itself should be seen as significant, but also whether in the recent trip that Anthony Blinken, Secretary of State, and Lloyd Austin, the Defense Secretary, made to the region, whether they were also sort of talking about these same things and getting any sort of sense of encouragement. Because you also had the U.S. reaching an agreement with South Korea on paying for basing in South Korea. You had Japan, under its new government of Prime Minister Suga, reasserting its support for doing more on defense. You seem to have them, certainly vis-a-vis the U.S., walking more in sort of in unison. Is that spilling over into their own relations, or do we know?
I think you're right, Bob. The fact that they're sitting down in and of itself is good news. Because again, relations between Seoul and Tokyo have been testy in the last several years, most notably with Japan halting the export of particular chemicals that were critical to the South Korean semiconductor industry as a highlight of how much tensions have risen. So again, yeah, I do think it's a good sign. I don't think this meeting can be expected to resolve all the differences between Japan and South Korea. It's not intended to do so, but again, the fact that they're talking is good. You still come down at the end of the day, though, to a fundamental challenge that the Biden administration faces in terms of its sort of basic intuition that the way that you confront China is to build this coalition of like-minded countries. And in these cases, what you discover is each country has slightly different perspectives on what the best strategy is. They also have different vulnerabilities. And I think that if you are particularly the South Koreans, you are concerned about economic pressure you could feel from China. I think the Japanese, to a lesser extent, but to some extent also are concerned about economic consequences. They look around and see that China has been very quick to exercise economic leverage against other countries. We've spoken earlier about how the Chinese responded to the call by Australia for a thorough investigation by the World Health Organization of the origins of the coronavirus. And they did so by essentially halting or putting tariffs on certain imports from Australia. We've seen recently that the Chinese government has singled out individual companies for their policies vis-a-vis China. H&M, which is this, I believe it's a Swedish-based company, which is very hot in the fashion field, has found itself sort of in the crosshairs of Beijing because it said it was not going to use cotton that came from Xinjiang because of the treatment of the Uyghurs. So countries are worried about sort of their exposure. And again, the Chinese policy is going to be divide and conquer. They're going to try to find the fissures in various places and play on those divisions because they don't want like-minded countries coming together and saying, we don't like your policies. We're going to coordinate ours. So this is a really big challenge for the Biden administration. I'll just close on this. We're still waiting to see the Biden administration to articulate in a full form what its policy toward China is going to be. We're doing a lot of intuiting right now from the statements the president makes, from statements that Secretary of State Blinken makes or Secretary of Defense Austin or Jake Sullivan. But the administration has its entire China policy under review. And again, we knew that from the get-go. We knew it was going to take several months. But at some point, they will roll it out and we'll get some sense, at least in terms of declaratory policy, in terms of sort of their public presentation of U.S. policy, how they're going to try to square the circle with these competing issues. Again, we want China's cooperation on North Korea. However, we want to oppose China on other issues. We think that the Trump administration's tariffs on China were counterproductive, but obviously, if we're going to give them up, we want to make sure we get something in return. There's just a lot of parts in that U.S.-China relationship that are really complicated that this administration still has yet to work through. And I think it's going to be some time before we actually get a clear idea of what their more granular approach to the challenge is going to be.
And as you say, while not publicly on the agenda, a lot of importance should be attached to this meeting in Annapolis, Jim.
You're right, Bob. This is an important meeting, and we'll see what conclusions emerge from it. But I should also note it's not the only meeting taking place in the coming week. On Monday, the annual spring meetings of the International Monetary Fund and the World Bank are set to kick off. Now, the annual spring meetings typically bring about 2,800 delegates from various member countries to Washington, D.C. Of course, because of COVID-19, these meetings, like most other meetings, will be held virtually. The meetings are set to focus broadly on issues of international development, debt, economic recovery, vaccines, and climate. Can you give us a little bit of background about these meetings, Bob, and what's likely to emerge from them?
Yes, Jim. First of all, it's important to have these individuals. These global meetings are virtually universal, really, in terms of the representation. Finance ministers, central bankers, economic ministers, and so forth, converging together. The two big bodies, which have buildings side by side in downtown Washington, the International Monetary Fund and the World Bank, convene a whole set of meetings, and it's really kind of sizing up the zeitgeist of global economic affairs. They both typically put out at least one big report at the kickoff of these meetings, sort of taking stock, in the IMF's case, taking stock of global growth projections, and the World Bank will typically look at, you know, global poverty levels and so forth. And that sort of sets the tone for the various discussions that take place. Now, virtually, you know, the virtual meeting kind of robs you of the opportunity for sideline conversations and conversations over, you know, shared meals and so forth, as has been the case with all the major global conferences in the past year. But still, there's also a pattern now to these virtual meetings where there's still a great deal of discussion going on. And it's a crucial point. Council on Foreign Relations just convened a meeting earlier this week with the managing director of the IMF, Kristalina Georgieva, who kind of laid out the big issues going on, but also the fact that it's a defining moment for the world, this pandemic, as we've heard again and again. It's also a defining moment for these institutions. And it's partly because they can play a really big role in bringing the rest of the world beyond the wealthy countries up and out of their trauma right now. The managing director pointed out in her meeting, she had a discussion with Fareed Zakaria through CFR virtual meeting auspices, in which she mentioned that, you know, while the United States has this new stimulus bill that's taking effect, you've had European countries putting a lot of money into play to combat the problems, health and otherwise, caused by the coronavirus. China has, as well as other rich countries have typically done. But poor countries, whether it's in Africa or anywhere else in the developing world, just simply don't have the firepower to do that. And so she was going out and sort of speaking out on the need for countries to use these massive global reserve assets that the IMF has in terms of issuing, you know, something like $650 billion in what's known as special drawing rights. And that could come from, you know, if member states approve that, member states of the IMF approve that, they could send this money to the poorer countries to give them immediate cash to take advantage of and sort of start dealing with their multiple problems. It's infrastructure. I mean, you just need to look at what the U.S. is trying to do in this moment. It's not only to respond to the virus and to sort of get vaccines into arms, but it's improving public health infrastructure, but then also all the other aspects of inequality that have hurt countries like the United States and have hurt many countries around the world, both autocracies and democracies. And so I think you're going to have a great deal of discussion about how there's this sort of enlightened self-interest in richer countries, not only helping to speed up vaccines worldwide, but then also speed up money flows and other things that will help lift these countries in so many other ways. But job one, I think, will be a discussion about, I think, improving the way the vaccine distribution process has gone, because it's, as all major, I think at this point, major experts in the world agree, you know, unless this virus is stamped out globally, it's going to haunt the entire world for years to come.
Bob, we've heard a lot of talk from the Biden administration about the importance of multilateralism and the importance of the United States being engaged in these multilateral organizations. And we've seen a lot of action on some fronts, particularly with the World Health Organization. Do we have any sense of how the Biden administration is going to be approaching organizations like the IMF and the World Bank?
That's going to be a really important takeaway that many are going to be looking for from these upcoming meetings. It does seem like that, in, as it has in its other steps, the Biden administration is going to want to work through international instruments and use the U.S.'s still considerable sway in helping sort of less fortunate countries through these steps like special drawing rights and so forth. But the Biden administration has also moved cautiously. It's still early days, it must be said as well. So we'll have to see how far this goes. The administration is clearly intent on ramping up and rapidly getting vaccines across the United States and is really focused on that heavily. There have been moves through the WHO, as you mentioned, but also you saw in the U.S. gesture towards Mexico sharing millions of vaccines with Mexico, which also, by the way, is a partner on trying to get under control the migrant flows that are continuing across the U.S.-Mexican border. But I think what we're going to be looking for is the extent to which the U.S. is willing to work with the IMF and World Bank in vigorous ways, whether it's on vaccine distribution or whether it's on all these other approaches to trying to combat, you know, whether it's ongoing malaises that countries were facing before the pandemic or, you know, using the pandemic moment to kind of lift these countries. But also it must be said, you know, let's get back to the China theme that you had mentioned earlier, Jim. You know, although China is a member of these bodies as well and has interests as well, the U.S. and its European allies have influence in ways that they can help countries that might be coming more fully under the sway of the Chinese through its Belt and Road Initiative and through its efforts to build infrastructure and assist countries from Africa across the breadth of Asia and so forth, and into South America, by the way. Maybe this is a way among the many ways that the Biden administration can work to counter the Chinese influence using the, you know, benign and good offices of these global development and finance institutions. So that's going to be really interesting as well. And I should mention, as I'm mentioning Belt and Road issues, I would be remiss in not mentioning a new task force report issued by the Council on Foreign Relations that looks at the scope of China's Belt and Road Initiative, its flaws, but also why it has been attractive to countries and what the U.S. could do to try to counter it as well.
I'm glad you mentioned the Council's Belt and Road Task Force report, Bob. I should note to people, you can download it at CFR.org, so the copies are available. And I think one of the key issues to follow in the months to come has to do this issue of Chinese lending to low-income countries. I think this is going to emerge as a bigger and bigger issue for two reasons. One, because of COVID-19, many poorer countries, emerging or developing economies, are going to find it increasingly difficult to repay money they have borrowed. That is particularly so if interest rates in the wealthy countries, particularly the United States, begin to go up, because capital will leave countries and head to places where people think they can get a better return on their money. But the other issue has to deal with the way the Chinese in the Belt and Road Initiative, which you can really think of sort of like the Marshall Plan on steroids, the way the Chinese in terms of lending have designed their loans. They have designed many of these loans in such a way that Chinese lenders have top priority in getting repaid, which gives China considerable leeway, considerable leverage in terms of getting repaid. And the Chinese, to this point, have shown themselves less willing than other countries to be willing to renegotiate loans when the borrowing countries are in a more difficult position to repay them. And one of the things I'd be really curious about, particularly at the IMF meetings, the extent to which this conversation about so-called emerging market debt is going to be an issue. Because obviously, the IMF is frequently called in when a country finds itself unable to pay its bills to try to restructure things so that these economies can get back on their feet. And that's a particularly painful process. And there are a lot of concerns about the way the IMF does it and whether it sort of factors in the right principles or not. But I think this is going to potentially be a significant issue going forward, again, especially if the global economy picks up and we see interest rates rise.
It's a really good point, Jim. And again, the IMF, you know, known for years for not only sort of coming to the rescue, but also, you know, sticking to a fiscal austerity to such a degree that it become deeply resented in a number of countries. Now what you're hearing, again, I'm basing some of this on some of the comments from the managing director, Georgieva, the other day. They're basically saying this is a time to spend, and this is a time for richer countries to help the developing countries spend more, despite what their postures are. But part of that is going to involve helping them to overcome debt problems and to give them the wherewithal to do what they need to do right now. So possible winds of change coming through. And again, it's a virtual meeting, but we'll sort of see how this conversation is going to play out.
But as you know, Bob, it's a lot easier to spend when you have a lot of money to begin with, a lot harder to spend when you don't have much to begin with.
Very true, Jim. Well, I want to keep this theme going, Jim, of important diplomacy, because we got another big one to talk about, potentially a big one. And that's an upcoming meeting between the President of the European Council and the President of the European Commission. That would be Charles Michel and Ursula von der Leyen, and the Turkish President, Recep Tayyip Erdogan. Now, the meeting's going to take place in Turkey in the coming week. It is seen as a step toward possibly improved relations between the EU and Turkey. So can you give us a sense of the scene that's going to be unfolding here? What do we need to know, Jim?
Well, Bob, I think you're quite right to note that we may be seeing an improvement in what has been a rather chilly time in EU-Turkish relations. There have been a lot of developments in the last several weeks, but let's sort of set the stage, which is that the EU and Turkey have been at odds for a while. The broadest factor here has been Erdogan's illiberal turn, moving away from what many people two decades ago saw as the triumph of an Islamic democracy into this illiberal quasi-democracy over the last decade or so. That general disagreement has been leavened with lots of disagreements on specific issues, perhaps most notably and most visibly about conflicting claims for exclusive economic zones in the Eastern Mediterranean, which have really pitted Turkey against EU members, Greece and Cyprus, and at one point had various navies shadowing each other in the Eastern Mediterranean. There also have been relatively small issues that have disrupted the relations. Now, note, recently Turkey left the Istanbul Convention, which is an agreement about preventing violence against women. So there's a backdrop of a lot of disagreement. But at the same time, the EU and Turkey have significant stake in each other's success. And I should note, obviously, economic connections. But also beyond that, one of the big issues, if we were to go back about 5 years ago, was the large-scale migration out of the Middle East into Europe and the turmoil that triggered across Europe. That led to a very important agreement between the EU and Turkey about limiting migration. And so there's a lot that each side has at stake. And again, in recent weeks, it appears that there has been a warming of relations. I'll note that just last week, the High Representative for Foreign Affairs for the EU released a report saying that the European Union should work closely with Turkey on trade, though it didn't call for removing the threat of sanctions, which have hung over the relationship for a while. And the call for sanctions are particularly strong from EU members, Greece and Cyprus. And again, Greece and Cyprus have long-standing historical enmity and disagreements with Turkey. But again, late last month, the EU concluded that it was important to resume cooperation with Turkey, but to do so, and let me quote them here, in a phased, proportionate, and reversible manner. That is, let's try it, but if it doesn't work, let's pull back.
Jim, I think it's fascinating that Turkey could be at this cusp of a reconciliation of sorts, although a cautious one, with the EU, given that, as you alluded to, that it's taken so many steps that put it firmly in the illiberal democracy, if not autocracy camp, but certainly steps that are even more extreme than even, you know, sort of Hungary and Poland have been taking, which are both facing actions by the EU for backsliding on democratic norms, whether you consider the role of the media or judiciary. I mean, Turkey has one of the worst records in imprisoning and cracking down on journalists, for example. And yet there seems to be this pragmatism that's coming through. And you mentioned the migrant agreement, which is, it's hard to overstate actually how crucial that was, because Europe was feeling beset by a migrant surge. And the deal with Turkey effectively quelled that. While migration still continue, the flows that were coming via Turkey slowed quite a bit. Turkey remains, I think, the country with the highest number of refugees on its soil. That is a no mean feat as well. So I think it's a lot of interesting areas of overlap. I'll be interested to see, Jim, at what your reference to the phased proportional steps actually amount to, like what this actually means in terms of Turkey potentially getting better economic treatment, perhaps, and then go from there?
Well, you're right, Bob. I mean, the art of diplomacy is about giving in order to get. But the problem is that you have to be willing to give, and there's a sequencing issue. Sometimes both sides are prepared to give, but they don't want to be the first one to do so. I think what the Turks want in particular is the dropping of the threat of sanctions against the Turkish economy. You may recall that at the end of last year, the EU moved to sanction Turkey over the issue of its behavior in the disputed exclusive economic zone. Turkey eventually removed its ships from these waters, and the EU hasn't moved forward with the sanctions. But again, you can have both sides going in with the best of intentions, but if they can't agree on what equates to proportionate and fair in terms of the step each side takes, nothing gets done. I think, you know, the most positive read on this upcoming meeting, as we're going to see the groundwork laid for a significant breakthrough and warming of relations. I think it's probably more realistic that it'll be some halting steps. And I think the fact that the EU signaled that whatever it does has to be done in a reversible manner signals both the challenge in finding common ground with the Turks and also maintaining common ground within the EU. And that may be just as important because, again, the EU, made up of more than two dozen member countries who have very different views on this issue of relations with Turkey, or may I should say, approach it with different intensity. The issue of relations with Turkey play much bigger in Greece and in Cyprus than they do in Estonia and Latvia.
No, that's well noted, Jim. And again, the EU, while being, as always, an effective economic union, the political union part continues to be a work in progress.
Well, just the fact that you have heads of two different bodies going to conduct the negotiations gives you some sense of the complexity of the way the European Union operates. But Bob, let's pivot and discuss our audience figure of the week, which listeners can vote on or tweet us at CFR_org. This week, our audience selected China's $400 billion Iran deal. Can you tell us a bit about the story that our audience has flagged?
Yes, and well, they should have flagged it. It's quite a big deal. There are still a number of details that remain to be surfaced, but this deal has been out and about for several years. Some details of it were actually floated, I think, last summer even. And it seems to be the one that they agreed on, which is the $400 billion figure you mentioned, which would be China investing roughly $400 billion over 25 years in Iran in all sorts of areas, including quite a bit of infrastructure, which the country is in dire need of. And in return, getting a steady supply of discounted Iranian oil. But there are also things in there like deepening military cooperation, which again, details remain to be seen on that, intelligence sharing. This is a really significant deal, potentially greatly significant. It does remain to be seen. The two countries have had growing relationships over the past several years. China is part of the international diplomacy that created the Iran nuclear deal, for example. Its perch on the UN Security Council has given it a lot of involvement, increasing involvement over Security Council deliberations on Iran as well, where you typically have the U.S. on one side and China and Russia on the other. But it's an opportunity, as Iran's Foreign Minister Javad Zarif said, China is a friend for hard times. So it's an opportunity to extend a bit of a lifeline to a country that remains under heavy sanctions, that is still taking very cautious steps to potentially coming back to the table with the United States and kind of rebooting the Iran nuclear deal, which the Biden administration said it wants to do. And, you know, potentially gives China a bigger stake in the region. That is a very big qualifier, though. It's not sure whether or not, you know, the full extent of this deal is going to be realized, partly because of some of the internal dissent that the deal has already generated in Iran.
I'm glad you flagged that last point, Bob, because there may end up being less to this deal than meets the eye. But I do think it signals two things that are important. One is it highlights the challenge the Biden administration has in its policy of trying to get back into the Iran nuclear deal, which is a lot of thinking here is predicated on the notion that the Trump administration built up a lot of leverage that the Biden administration can use to extract concessions from the Iranians. But if China and other countries are willing to work with Iran, provide it with economic benefits, that leverage becomes significantly less than it would be otherwise. Now, that doesn't help the Biden administration because if people believe it has leverage and it isn't seen as exercising it, that's a political problem. I think the other thing, though, to sort of flag in this whole deal is I wouldn't operate on the assumption that China has now allied itself with Iran, as I think some of the commentary implies. The entire way the Chinese have conducted their foreign policy has really been transactional. They're looking to get things out. They're not looking to do favors for people. They're not looking to build an alliance of allies. They mostly want people to provide them with things. So I'm not sure I would, again, necessarily assume that flowing from this is going to be an Iranian-Chinese axis. And on one level, sort of have to, you know, hit the brakes a little bit about where this might all end up going. That relationship could deepen, and you can see sort of the geographical reasons why it might be, and the economic reasons. Obviously, the Chinese need oil. But again, I wouldn't go from this agreement to all of a sudden sort of mapping out of the scene they're able to do this sort of block, which is China, Russia, Iran, and we'll be throwing lots of other countries into the mix as this block could happen. Not saying it can't, but I wouldn't say it's most likely or something that's likely to come about quickly or will be a particularly durable horrible alignment.
Yeah, I think it's worth stressing that, Jim. And I would just say, even though they're different circumstances, it's worth looking at the Iran relationship with Russia over the years. You know, again, these are two very different countries, just like Iran and China, two very different countries. And yet they found some reason to continue to maintain contacts. Russia has even shared civilian nuclear know-how with Iran, although it seems to be the case that both Russia and China are also intent on Iran not developing nuclear weapons capability. And, you know, Russia and Iran made common cause in Syria as well in terms of protecting the Assad regime. But you can't really call that an alliance either. They just sort of have found places where they can find common goals. But there are other things and other major differences between them that make it more problematic. I think you're seeing Iran, from Iran's perspective, it's, again, playing a pretty weak hand, pretty deftly still. And by going into this agreement at the very moment, and apparently it was ordered by the Supreme Leader, but doing this at the very moment that there are these very sensitive talks going on with the U.S. is seen as potentially really strengthening its hand in what it may demand of the U.S. if there's to be any sort of future to the Iran nuclear deal.
Yeah, just two quick things on that point, Bob. One is I do think for the Iranian leadership, being able to ink this deal is important domestically to be able to offer up to Iranians, many of whom are deeply dissatisfied with this regime's handling of the economy, that there are good times in the future, that there's reason to be hopeful. The other thing just to keep in mind is that when China looks at the Middle East, it's not just looking at Iran as a possible source of oil. It's also very interested in getting oil from Saudi Arabia. And if, in fact, the United States continues to become energy independent, or at least need less to import oil or relies less on oil if it can make a successful shift to a green revolution, for the Chinese and for the Saudis, there is a potential relationship to develop there. So I wouldn't imagine the Chinese are going to ruin their opportunity to get secure oil supplies from Saudi Arabia by getting too close to Iran. So again, there are multiple factors and forces going in different ways. Important to keep in mind as we assess where this region's going.
And that's our look at the world of diplomacy next week. Here are some other stories to keep an eye on. Bulgaria holds general elections. The anniversary of NATO's founding is marked. And Christians celebrate Easter Sunday.
Please subscribe to The World Next Week on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, wherever you get your podcasts, and leave us a review while you're at it. They help us get noticed and improve the show. Please note that opinions expressed in The World Next Week are solely those of the hosts or our guests, not of CFR, which takes no institutional positions on matters of policy. Today's program is produced by Zoe Collis with senior producer Jeremy Sherlock. Zoe also did double duty as a recording engineer. Thank you, Zoe. Special thanks go out to Anna Shortridge and Bethany Wright for their assistance. Our theme music is provided by Miguel Herrero and licensed under Creative Commons. This is Jim Lindsay saying goodbye.
And this is Bob McMahon saying so long and stay healthy out there.